7. This is an interview with Tony Waters at his home, 71 Birdwood Avenue. Interviewed by Bruce Ringer, Manager Research Services, Manukau Libraries. The 1st of December 2005. Tony, I thought we might talk about your life and times, particularly in Waiuku. You were born in Waiuku?
Yes, I was born in the Franklin Memorial Hospital, Waiuk, on the 24th of July, 1929. I was the second child of Philip and Isabel Waters. My father was born in Patamahoe. His grandfather was one of the first European settlers, Philip Henry was his name, who settled in Patamahoe in 1865 in May. They landed, there was about 40 of them, they landed in a scow at Takihi Inlet. That is where the bridge is on the Glenbrook to Drury Road, an inlet there not far from Patamahoe. They landed there, and my grandmother, whom I knew very well, she died in 1951. She was only an infant then in 1865. She left me great intimate details of her family in Ireland and what it was like in those days. Now, her father owned the land which is now Patamahoe. The whole of Patamahoe Township was Henry's farm. They built the first store there. They built the Bowling Green was part of their farm, and the Catholic Church was built there in 1889 for my grandmother's wedding, built on their farm, and it's still there today, although it's been sold. Now, my father, of course, left Patamahoe when he grew up and went to the First World War, Gallipoli, and right through the Sinai campaign. And by that, when he came back from the war, his parents had a small farm in Hulls Road, and he was had very ill health. He'd been badly wounded in the First World War, and it took him a few years to recover. So he stayed at home, although he did work at odd jobs. But eventually he worked. He got married in 1927, and he was working then in the Wallace Supplies as an assistant in the grocery shop at Waiuk. He was involved with everything in the township, you might say, the RSA and sports bodies and the progress of the town and the church. Now, he eventually, in 1930, became manager of Wallace Supplies, where he was manager until 1965, all those years. So he was there right through the war. He was the Herald agent, and we lived right in the township, so my whole life centred around Waiuk. And I used to love listening to stories, especially from my grandmother and elderly people who frequented our place, about Waiuk and the past and what things were like there. Things I remember as a child, well, there was the Depression, and they opened a public works camp at Waiuk, out at Maioro, and they started planting lupins in the sand, and eventually it became a great pine forest. And I can remember as a little boy, about 1934, one Sunday night, somebody was knocking at the door, and there was a couple of men. They'd walked from Auckland to Waiuk to get a job. They'd heard about the public works camp there. So my father referred them to somebody, and eventually, of course, they ended up there.
Do you remember the work camp down in the Akaka swamps, the Otau swamps?
No, that was earlier. They were just small ones, but they were where they were draining the land, if you understand. They sort of moved from place to place. The one that I remember is the Maioro Public Works Camp. See, that was eventually bought by Carters. Strange enough, I worked there in the 1950s during the university holiday, so I knew that place quite well.
Where did you go to school?
Waiuk. I started school, it was a wet May, in I think it was the 26th of May, 1935. Now, I remember the day because most of the mothers brought their children there and dropped them off, but of course I wasn't brought by my mother. She had two or three younger children that my elder sister just dropped me in the classroom. That was that. And I can remember, even I've still got a picture of my class in those days. Margaret Hughes, who became New Zealand Lady Golf Champion in 1949, she started that day. She is now Mrs. Roy Purden. Roy Purden was what New Zealand's leading trotting trainer. There was another girl there, the Nairi Arkell. Her sister was also in the Primus class there that we called a Billy Alma. Well, Alma married David Levine of Levine's, and Billy married a fellow, Douglas, who was a chemist, and he became a huge chemicals, Douglas Chemicals importers. And there was the Arkells had the grocery shop over the road from Waller Supply, so they were always friends of ours. And Des Barrable, he's I've a friend of his all his life, a friend of mine. He was in the class then, and there were several Maori children. They all unfortunately, the Maori children, you didn't have to start school. You didn't have to start school until you were six in those days. So most of the Maoris didn't come until they were six. However, you were allowed to start at the you could only start at the beginning of the term, and if you were going to be six during that term, you could start at the beginning of the term. So probably the Pākehās, Europeans, had a little advantage that way. I can always remember two children who were unfortunate, well, mentally we'd say handicapped or slow, came to school, and often they were troublesome. There was no program especially for them, and they could easily get bored at school.
Well, what was the teaching style in those days like?
It varied, but I must say, I always thought it was harsh. I'll never forget, even in the first term there, I remember the old lady teacher, I know her name, perhaps best left unspoken. She'd belt children with a leather strap, and I remember one little girl, she belted her and then started belting around the legs with a leather strap. It was pretty harsh, really. The principal, he was dignified. I remember he was a Mr. Park, and then we had Norman Day. Norman Day was a great man for music and the stage show. He used to put on these lovely plays and music things. He wasn't that harsh, but many of the teachers were. They would easily lose their temper and belt into people. But however, there were one or two were quite good, really. I always remember one teacher. It said he'd been around the world, and he said that the journey from Auckland to Waiuk was a journey through some of the finest agricultural land in the world, with beautiful trees and green grass and lovely coast, little inlets, coastal inlets, you might say harbour inlets of Manukau. And I always dreamed then, I thought, I'm going to go around the world one day. And so I suppose, in a way, school was good for me. I like sport and I like company, and I like stories and reading and poetry. I always used to, I can remember winning poetry competitions, so I ended up being a teacher and managed to get round the world. And I'll never forget, I would still say that the beautiful green land with native bush on it between Auckland and Waiuk would be some of the finest pastoral land in the world.
Can you give me some of your impressions of the town? Can you remember the town as it was like in the late 30s, say, early 40s?
Yes, it was a compact town. There was never, it never seemed to expand, and there were empty sections in the shop. I remember, like, Dad Wallace Supplies, it was opposite the National Bank. Well, between his shop and the Methodist Church, there was just vacant land, unused land, that section, right up, I think, till after the war. It seems funny, doesn't it? As you might say, almost in the main street. The hotel, fortunately, was down the end of the town, because with the 6 o'clock closing, especially during the Depression, it was there were always drunks being hurled out of it, you might say, at night, and it was best probably where it was, down there by the wharf. There was a billiard saloon next to Arkell's bakery shop there, and there was always often a bit of trouble there, young people coming there. But, there were horse and carts too, you know. A lot of people couldn't afford cars in those days. And even the cream was delivered to the White Butter Factory by horse and carts. Some of them, most of them did have trucks in those days, but some of them still brought it in by horse and carts of dray. I remember a chap, Somerville, came past our place every morning with two horses and a cart of cream. He brought it in from Kariotahi, but he lost the contract to a truckie one year, and that was the end of the old horse and carts.
Oh, did petrol restrictions during the war?
Yes. Now, the petrol restrictions, I think they came about 42 or 43. But really, in those days, very few people drove to work. People walked to work, rode bikes, and cars were more recreational. Going to Auckland by car was a treat for us. Probably happened once a year. And I can remember my father wouldn't go anywhere in the car for a few months, and he'd save up enough petrol from his coupons to get us to Auckland once every few months to visit relations, and those are always a thrill. But essential services, doctors and bakers or butchers and grocers who delivered their things had a special petrol allowance, so there were plenty of commercial vehicles still going. Although the doctor, Dr. Howden, had two cars. Well, the war realisation, what was it, the War Emergency Board took one of his cars, compulsory took it from him and bought it, of course, because they said, no, one car's enough. So,
were there social distinctions in Waiakua in those days? You mentioned Dr. Howden had two cars. He also had a fine house.
Mm. Well, yes and no. Dr. Howden had been to the First World War, and so did my father, and they were great friends. In fact, they used to buy a truck of coal and share it. And my father had no education apart from primary school. But, he took half the coal, and we had half the coal because, our heating was all by coal. So, yes, but I would say it wasn't so much, as I'd say, but its social distinction is, how would I say, interest. Colonel Aldred, he came from a well-to-do family. He was a perfect gentleman, if you understand. He always ran he played bowls, he played cricket with the ordinary people. And there were people like that. There were some families that kept to themselves. I would say there were some families, you know, who, there was a lot of money made by farmers who never spent their money or did much. I always remember one farmer died, he was very wealthy, and somebody said, it looks as though he wore the same suit all his life. Now, what I'm saying is that they didn't sort of have much cultural interest. You often wonder what they did with themselves. They probably went shooting and boating and things like that. Yes, now, it's a difficult question, cultural interest. There were some people but who probably felt themselves a little cut above everything, but they were soon sorted out. I better be careful on this one because I always remember years later, some person stood for some school board or something, and the teacher said to me, how come they weren't elected? He's well educated in this. I said, there were little family feuds. I said, way back in the past, in the 1860s, when Europeans were taking up the land, people were often jealous of people who got more land than they should have. And there were little disputes like that. There were some strange disputes. People would never sell cattle to certain people and this type of thing. It goes way back, you know, that they thought that they were cut above somebody or that they got more than their share of land and that type of thing. But you could go on about these sort of things in a small town, but everybody really, I would say on the whole, it was a friendly town. Because Dad, my father being the Herald agent, and I used to deliver the Heralds from an early age in the late 30s, you got to know, I would say everybody was good to you, nice. People came out and they always spoke and friendly, that type of thing. And I think they sort of looked at, if you were one of the past, you were one of the families, if, you know, the old families that were there, you see.
What about if you weren't one of the old families?
Well, you had to sort of make yourself felt, didn't you, really? People often resented strangers coming in. I always remember there's somebody in who comes in and say, I tell you what, bank clerks or post office people, and they joined the golf club or the tennis club and the bowling club. They didn't like them to sort of take over the club and, you know, try to... They often resented this sort of people, these sort of people trying to tell you, you know, how to run your town and this type of thing. I remember my father, when he left the store there, the firm put in another manager, and he came along and said what he was going to do and what he wasn't going to do, and my father said, yes, they come here like this and think they're going to be big fish in, very quickly in a small town, but they often run into trouble. You mustn't offend people, as he said. You know, people have got these long traditions. But on the whole, people gradually, if they were polite, I suppose, and came in and helpful and that type of thing, who contributed to the town, like people would come in and start a choir and things like this. And, you know, I remember somebody started an aero club. And on the whole, no. I mean, there's probably, on the whole, I would say, most people were accepted, provided they didn't try to turn the town upside down.
Well, I recall my father arrived in Waiakua in 1951, and within a few weeks of getting there, I think even before he was living there permanently, he was elected onto the Businessmen's Association.
Well, there we are. Well, that was.
Do you think that aroused resentment? Or?
It may have, provided he didn't. I would say, provided he didn't upset things. Now, strangely, you should say that, but my father was deputy chairman of the town board then.
Right.
And I remember this, you know, way back, that your father came into my father, and there was a turnstile, tubular steel turnstile gate at the hall, the town hall there, in a little lawn. And children used to play on this. And I remember, you know, they weren't supposed to, but children would play on it. And one child was supposed to have fallen off and broken his ankle. And your father came and spoke to my father at the town board. And I always remember my father said to him, he said, look, we've had that there for 20 or 30 years for the War Memorial Hall. And there's a notice that children aren't to play on it. And he said, look, we're not going to go and just lock it up for that type of thing. So you probably got a bit of that, but I wouldn't say it was anything. No, so, you know, little things like that. I remember this manager came to the shop, and this new manager, now I've forgotten his name, and my father left the 60, and he said that the shops need to join the business more, and started telling me where they should paint their shop fronts, etc., and this needed done, and doing. Well, some of the people wouldn't have liked that. After all, people always said shopkeepers were mean. Well, some of them were mean. They were very careful about spending money on their shop, you know, so that they couldn't see anything. So, yes, but your father, he probably got there, you know, but let's be honest, some people couldn't be bothered doing anything anyway, you know, really. But and he was probably keen, a young lawyer, and wanted to see things done, so there we are, you just don't know.
Well, going back to what you said earlier, what about culture life? What did you do for entertainment and culture, if you'd like?
Well, the cinema, the old Lyceum Cinema, they used to have a film, the same film was shown on Tuesday night and Wednesday night. On Saturday night, they had there was a matinee on Saturday, and then it was ordered a feature film, invariably a Western or low-class film. And on Saturday night, the theatre would be absolutely packed, all the young people and everything. Strangely enough, the Maori community, they would flock in. And if the film was annoying people and no good, they'd yell out, and this would resent people. And I can remember one night, one stupid film, I was probably about 7 or 8 at the time, because we lived over the road from the theatre. My father would probably let us go about once a fortnight, but not to every time. Every film, just certain times, and certain films they probably wouldn't let us go to. Anyhow, but this particular night was some Western, and there's a wild horse, and these chaps were chasing it in a lorry, and it showed the speedometer getting up to 20 mile an hour, 25, 30. I remember one old lady in the town that used to go to all the pictures started yelling out, "You cruel brutes, you arrogant fellas," and people telling her to keep quiet. And then one night, I remember another film, a woman was being kicked out for not paying the rent of some place during the Depression in some American film. And as she got kicked out, the landlady grabbed hold of her suitcase and said, "I'm keeping this till you come back and pay the rent you owe me." And I remember a huge Maori fella yelled out, "You battle axe!" And the whole theatre erupted. And I can remember coming home and saying, asking my parents, what did he mean by the word battle axe? And then there was another, some people in the town, I better be careful who I state, but they would go to every film, every Thursday, or every Tuesday or Wednesday, and every Saturday. There was a list of them. They'd come to, they'd be there every time. One was a chap, Ronnie Harris. His father had been the long-term principal of the primary school. He was a bit of a slow learner, but he never married, and he ran his father's farm, and he'd always be there every time. And sometimes, I can remember, he went out at half-time once, and he had a better seat than somebody else, and some big Maori man came in and took a seat. And when he came in after half-time, the fellow said, "No, you're in the wrong row," and told him he had to go somewhere else. Little things like that went on. And yes, they would come to every single film that would be there. So, right, that's one thing about entertainment. Then what else? Oh, we had our own sports. I can remember during the war there were no men, and a group of us boys, we would go up to the Massey Park, organise ourselves into cricket teams and play among ourselves. And then we used to have little, you know, rugby games among ourselves also. So we did a lot of, and I can remember our street, we had our own athletic sports once in a farm paddock. Talking about amusing yourselves, during the holidays it was boring because you couldn't go anywhere. We'd go up to the sale yards or go up to the railway. And I can remember on sale yards, every second Friday was sale yards day, and cattle would come in down our street, Martin Street, into the town. And often cattle would break away from mobs, and we used to love watching the drovers chasing after them and try and get them back. And sometimes they'd get into paddocks if gates were left open. So we would, often during the holidays, Saturday, we'd get up, sneak out and open farm gates, hoping that cattle would break from the mob and get in them, and then we'd be able to watch the drovers chase them. Children, it's amazing how children can create or do damage or get up to mischief, really, when they're bored. Or that we used to do a lot of fishing. I remember once we went out and caught frogs one day, a group of boys during the holidays. Some of them were older than I. And then they didn't know what to do with the frogs, and they started chopping their heads off. Well, I didn't involve in this, but my sister went and told my mother. And did I get into trouble with my parents, although I wasn't even involved in it. But things like this we'd often do. We'd walk out to the coast, you know, or sand spit, the beach. We'd all walk or drive down there. So, you know, you're saying, you know, about how you do music groups. Now, oh yes, so we all learnt the piano and music. There were, you know, Zena Finley and Mrs. McIntosh, you know, most of the people in the town learnt the piano and music. And she used to put on, you know, once a year she'd have a display, you know, and we'd concert. And as I said, Norman Day, the principal during the year, he used to put on these lovely musicals. And they were good, they're packed like that. Yes, you had to make your own fun, didn't you, type of things? And that type of...
Did you listen to the radio much?
Oh, yes, the radio. You know, even during the war, a lot of people didn't have radios. They couldn't afford them. Short wave, there were very few people who had short wave. My father had a short wave, and I remember children in the street would come along to listen to it. You know, we'd have all... That's the radio was probably our main source of information in the New Zealand Herald. I better be careful this, but people waited for their Herald. I used to deliver Heralds in the morning, and people be waiting out for the Herald, wondering what the war news was. And we still, you know, how's things going in the war? And and if God help you, if you forgot somebody's giving them the Herald. In fact, my father once said, "It's the cow cocky's Bible, and they have to have it or look out."
You were a Catholic, weren't you?
Yes.
Your family was Catholic.
Yes.
What was the life in the Catholic community like? And was there any religious division in the town?
I wouldn't say so. Look, my father had been in the army. He was deputy chairman of the RSA. He could never be chairman or president of the RSA because his commanding officer, Colonel Aldred, was always chairman. Well, that was understandable. He was a gentleman. No, my father would never allow us to, in no criticism at all of other religions, God help you, etc., etc. He said, look, they are my bread and butter, if you understand. But look, there probably were people with prejudice, but really, I remember a lady of strict Presbyterian in our street. Her husband died and left with children. And I always remember one old lady came and said to me, she said, your mother had six children. When her husband died, who was the first person that came along and brought her food and helped her? It was your mother, Catholics. And this woman had no religion at all. And those are the things I remember, really, from that point of view. And there was, the churches really were cooperative, and when they had fairs, people would help one another. Except I often know friends about marrying. One a Catholic wanted to marry a Protestant, or vice versa. There was always a little bit of trouble there, but some people were indifferent and some just, forgot, gave it away. But that always created a bit of problems at times. But I think in the end, everybody seemed to... Most people who are genuine Christians did tolerate one another, and I would say no, I wouldn't say that. There were sayings at times that certain men who had shops went and preached in certain churches, and that sort of attracted business. I don't know whether that's true.
Would it be fair to say that churches played a bigger part in the life of the town then than they would today?
They ran dances. That was very popular. The Bilts, they were a Catholic family and a music family, and they had an orchestra, and they would run dances, for the church and that type of thing. And the Anglicans, they used to have dances also. The clergymen always came to the school once a week, and spoke to people. And often a lot of the children didn't know what religion they were, but they... But that was something that was sort of Bible in schools. What else did this... Now and again, there was one priest I told way back there, a Catholic priest, way back in the 1920s. He was supposed to have got into some controversy. A Father Taylor, he's supposed to have got in controversy writing letters to the Wyuk News about certain religious things and getting into controversy, but... It gradually died down. Most people want a peaceful life. Don't want to get into that sort of thing.
Referring back to the war, you said there were no men in the town. Did a lot of people volunteer, or were they conscripted?
Yes, they did. I didn't quite say there were no men in the town. There weren't many young men, if you understand. Right. Now, farmers got exemption, etc. And but yes, a lot of men, left. Some men, there were quite a few volunteers, and some didn't. There were sort of people resented people that didn't volunteer. I heard once that old Dr. Howden is supposed to have said to somebody in some shop, he says, "Have you ever heard of the word volunteer?" And he wouldn't buy from some shop because he felt that somebody was working there who should have volunteered. Now,
talking about conscription and Dr. Howden putting a little pressure on somebody he thought should have volunteered?
Yes, but I don't think they did anyway. Most of the men there in Wyke were proud of their war service. Colonel Aldred and, the knights. And when I look back, guys, and it's my father in the First World War, there were men there, Tosh Peterson, who had the hotel. They were in the same... Mounted Rifle Regiment and on Gallipoli together. The Knights used to have the butcher shop. He was at the war with my father, the chap Eisenhut, the Craigs. Dad sort of had all these great friends,
because they were mounted rifles in the First World War, and these were farming people, so most of them had great camaraderie, you might say, among them. But there were the ones that didn't want to go to the war, you know, when they stuck on their farm or that type of thing. I remember teachers, they said, you know, the only men teachers we had were elderly teachers or crocs or men who probably something was the matter with them. But Wyoak is a very conservative town, you know, you might say, in that point of view. And always everybody would talk about the war, etc., etc. You know, they'd go down to the pub and they'd tell them, and then they'd kick out in the street and have arguments about the war and what went on and what didn't. So, now, the Olsen family, now there was a proud family as regards war service. All the Olsen boys were in the Air Force during the war. And they were, sort of, in many ways, you know, they're sort of heroes from that point of view. And, of course, there were two air crashes on training flights in Wyoak, of which I saw the results when I was at school in 1943 and 44. And I remember that one of Warbrick on a training flight from Ardmore, who crashed in the golf course in August 1944. His brother was in the same class as I was at school, and his sisters. And many years later, I said to that family, you people should put a little monument in memory of your Barney, Sergeant Pilot Barney, on the spot where he crashed. I said, I remember it on the golf course. And strangely enough, it was only a few months ago that eventuated, thanks to Bill Deed and the Warbrick family. They unveiled a lovely little memorial to him on the golf course just opposite Howden Street on memory of Barney Warbrick, who was the first. He was a local boy, and he was the first member of his tribe to qualify as a fighter pilot during the war. Unfortunately, he never got overseas because he crashed there at Wyoak. But thank God, at long last, we've got a little memorial to him on the spot where he died.
Oh, you yourself were too young for war service.
Of course.
But eventually you did.
I was born in 1929, so I was 16 when the war ended at school. It was my last year at school. I remember the day at school that the atom bomb was dropped. Monday the 6th of August. It was the last week of the August holidays, and it was the first year we had school cert, and we were preparing for it at the end of the year. I remember that day well. And that was the Monday, and then they wouldn't surrender. By the Wednesday, the second one was dropped. They surrendered, so we broke up on the Thursday, so we got a holiday. I was at boarding school in Auckland and came home that night. In May 1945, the first week of the May holidays, the war ended in Europe, so we missed out on a holiday for that one, but we did.
You decided to go and train to be a priest.
I did, yes. That was because I loved history, and I used to read history books of great missionaries, Jesuits, who were the first to take Christianity into China and India. And these men were very clever men. They started a university. I think part of that university still exists in China. And so they had a college in Australia, and they came over here, and I went over there, and it was in a great year. I learnt a lot about life, you know, and discipline. Discipline was the thing, where everything in life was ordered. And I trained there for a while, but I unfortunately, how would I say? I think I got a bit run down. I got sick. I keep getting ill, and I was told to have a break from studies, which I did. So I came back, and I worked in the bank for a while. And then I knew that I was something troubled, some sort of nervous problem. So I became a postman for 3 years. And in Auckland, and it was great because it was Mission Bay, where lovely houses and people were nice. I'd finish about midday or 1 o'clock, I'd hurry and go to university, and I managed to complete my BA while working as a postman. And at the time, there were other students working, because you see, as a postman, you got the afternoons off if you were a good quick delivery man. And chaps that are doctors today, and some fellas even, one chap, believe it or not, who became Chancellor of Massey University, same name but no relation, Dr. Neil Waters. He worked as a postman with me at that time, and I still know him. I often meet him after all those years. Anyhow, so I eventually became a teacher and never looked back. I loved teaching. I've had 45 years in the classroom, and that's when I managed to get overseas.
Did you train at Ardmore, did you?
No, I trained at Auckland Teachers College because I was doing my MA, so I stayed on there.
What was your first school?
My first school was a lovely school. It was Westmere, over the road from the zoo. And it was a working class area, but how would I say, upper working class. They were tradesmen. They were people, they were the men. Well, I think of some of the fellows, they were truck drivers or tradesmen or worked in the post office or builders or carpenters. Now, and then I can remember my first year I took a rugby team. And looking back on that rugby team, half that rugby team became representative players. One of them was Brian Fairley. He would have been an All Black, except that he went on to tennis and became, you know, New Zealand tennis champ. There was a boy, McIntyre, who played halfback for Auckland. His brother played cricket for Auckland. There were six Bailey boys. They all played for rugby league. Well, no, three of them, I think, represent New Zealand at rugby league. One of them is married to the Rapatis, who was a league rep, and I taught him at school later on. So, an interesting story. I remember that year we got into the final of the Auckland Primary School, but we had championships and we had to get transport to go down to Victoria Park to play the final. And the father of these six Bailey boys, only a couple of them on my team, who became, as I said, league reps, he was president of the New Zealand Freezing Workers Union. He said, "Don't worry, I'll have a car there." Believe it or not, we had to go, I think you'd be there 12:30. Here was a big car, turned up, the union car, picked us, you know, half the boys up, we crammed them in. And I said, "How'd you get at this?" He said, "Well, I was chairing this meeting at the Trades Hall. This is the president of the Freezing Workers Union." And he said, "Gentlemen, I have some serious personal business to tend to, but I'll be back in 15 minutes. And that was a serious personal business to see that his boys got to the rugby final.
When did you get to Waiuku Primary?
We had to do country service in those days. So after teaching at Westmere, then I went to Avondale Intermediate for a year. And then you sat what was called a salary bar. You didn't get any increase in salary till you went to a country school. So Waiuku, my hometown, was a good school. So I got there, I think, about 59 to 62. You had to do 3 years country service. Then from there I went to Pukekohe High School.
Oh, yes, I recall you were my teacher in Standard 2, wasn't it?
Standard... was it Standard 2 or 4? But I remember you were... Yes, Bruce, I don't think it was Standard 2. I think it was higher than that. It's 60... I think it was 62, wasn't it? It was 63 or 62. We had the Roller Mills tournament there, I remember, too. Yes, you were saying about that? What about it, Bruce?
I remember you.
Nasty beggar?
No, as a very kindly sort of teacher.
Oh, thank you. But I remember you, and there was the boy Hodgson. You know, we were clever children, you were. And I remember there's Billy Deed. He was very interested in, you know, history and things. And so he liked history, Billy. And I said, "I've got him to do a project on Waiuku, the history." He did it. And I said, send it to a school in New Zealand. So he looked at the map. He said, "Oh, look down there, Bluff." I said, "All right." So he sent it to Bluff. And he got a letter back from a girl with a lovely, with a project on Bluff. And I was talking to Bill Deed some time ago, and he said, "I still remember the name of that girl." And Bill ended up, of course, president of the Waiuku History Association, you know, and running a printing business, publishing. I remember... You used to read tremendously, didn't you? I remember you used to come through to Auckland to the library service and get cartons of books and sent them down to Waiuku. And I remember I remember once there was one in the motor car and you told me, "You know, I learnt more about the motor car by reading that book than I did in the for the past life, I remember you said. Yes, some of the children there weren't interested, I suppose, in schooling, but on the whole, mind you, looking back, classes were crowded. We had over 40 children. Some poor children suffered from dyslexia, which people didn't know much about in those days, and I often felt, they missed out. School became an unhappy place for them, and many of them were glad to leave, especially, where they had no interest in reading. But I realise now that a lot of them had never been given the rights, hadn't been taught the right way, or, their interests hadn't been aroused. Although some children there were good. I remember there was one boy there, Boy Douglas, I think. His father used to, was a taxidermist, and he, this boy, and he came to school and showed us, a bird that he had, mounted and stuff and things like that. I remember taking children to Auckland. It was really a treat for children, country children in those days. I realised when I went to boarding school what I'd missed out on at Wyuk. I can remember we were behind when I got to secondary school in Auckland. I didn't know as much as the other boys in my class, and it took a while to catch up. And I realised that often in those days, in the war and that in the country schools, we missed out on many things, you understand. We didn't have the material, the books often, type of thing.
So you went on to Pukekohe High School?
Yes, that was quite good, yes.
That was under Bert Drever, was it?
Yes, Mr. Drever, he's... it was all right, although... you don't like criticising schools, but on the way... Bert Drever was a fatherly sort of figure, but he was mixed up in Rotary, and he liked to sort of create the image, of a good school and all this. There's Rotary, and he used to bring in these Rotarians to talk, and I always remember we had to listen to one once who told us that the Second World War started. Second World War, because we took Germany's colonies from them in the First World War, and they all wanted the colonies back. Now, that's rubbish, in my opinion, having done an MA in history. I don't think... Hitler wanted to, obviously, dominate Europe and take Europe, but I don't think Hitler had any idea. He didn't have the navy or any way to want to come out in the Pacific and take over colonies, etc., like that. And I often thought, I often wonder, about... Bert Drever, and then he brought in some person who'd met some German missionary in the war, and they'd spoken something about something there. But I often wonder, Bert Drever, perhaps it would have been better if he worried more about school, just keep on to school, My father used to say during the war, all these people that had their own opinions, he used to call them spittoon philosophers. They'd have a few drinks and then they'd start philosophising about history and the war. However, so Pukekohe, it was a nice school, I would say. They made good friends there, I still see things. It's one thing that's interesting now, there's a website, Teachers in Search of Pupils, Pupils in Search of Teachers. Somebody's put my name on it, and often I get emails from all around the place. Dear Mr. Waters, you taught me at Pukekohe High School in 1966. One day, and my wife, I was talking to my wife one day about teachers, and she said that she had a Mr. Waters at Odahoo College. And then I realised it was the same teacher. I said, how interesting. And he told me what he was doing in life. That was very nice. And then I got one from a girl in Hawaii once. Should you taught me at Odahoo College in 1971? I was the quiet little Chinese girl that always sat in the front, and she told me what she'd done, etc. Then you get others like, you got one once from a chap, he says, I was in your class, fifth form in 1975 or something, at Odahoo College. Now, I have the school photo. Now, there was a girl there by, Janine Nilsson. I wonder, do you know where she is now, what her name was? What her name is now if she's married. Do you know where she is? I'd like to get in touch. I thought, I better be careful on this one. I wonder, has he lost his wife and looking for some other girl, trying to chase after them? often you have to be careful in that sort of thing. And then I got one from one person, oh, you taught me in 1968. And I, it was in London. And he said, I hated school. I never did any homework. I never studied for exams. I was cheeky to the teachers. I couldn't even get a reference when I left school. Now I own two companies and I own a house in Pakuranga. So I sent a message back to him. I said, very good, very good. We must have had some influence on you, but thank God there are people who do work and study and achieve to create a society where chaps like you can progress.
So did you go on to Rotorua College from Pukekohe?
Yes, I went on there.
When was this, in the 70s?
1965. And at the end of 1967, I resigned from Rotorua College to go overseas and teach in London. And the principal said, look, whenever you want to come back, write to me a few months before and there'll be a job here for you. He didn't keep my job open, of course. He couldn't. So that was great. I had over 2 years in London and travelled the whole world, because you get quite a lot of holidays there. And living in London, will you, there was always somewhere to go. As Johnson said, the man who's tired of London's tired of life, for there is in London all that a man should want in life. And their
Yeah, so what was Rotorua like in those days?
Interesting. Rotorua was one of the biggest, had the biggest role of any high school in New Zealand. In fact, after the war, they went up to 1,600, and they were teaching even in shelter sheds. Now, it was a working-class area, freezing workers and railway workshop workers. And it started off as a technical high school in 1931. When it opened in 1931, it was the only school between Auckland Grammar and Pukekohe High School. So people came, you know, from South Auckland and etc. Strangely, it was next door to King's College. And generally, we kept good relations with King's College. In fact, some of them used to come over to our school for bookkeeping or commerce, which yet at a higher level wasn't taught at King's College from that point of view. But I don't think any pupils from Rotorua College went over to King's College for classes. That was different. Now, there were only 10% of the pupils would be Maori or Polynesian. Today, 30 years later, 99% are Polynesian or Maori. So it shows you how this area has changed over those years. Academically, they produce some good ones. There's a few professors have come from there, type of thing. And Sir Barry Curtis, the mayor, went there. David Longy went there. But it wasn't always easy there. The children could be very intimidating at times, you know, especially if they weren't interested in what you were teaching and that type of thing. In those days, though, commerce and woodwork and metalwork and home economics, they were sort of the subjects for working class girls. So people who wanted to succeed academically had to invariably go into Auckland Grammar. But there were good people there, I would say. And now it's all, as you say, it's all Polynesian. And the Polynesians, I found, are very friendly. So much so that I remember one holiday I went over to Fiji and remote islands, you know, in January, during the school holidays, and stayed with people over there. It was a great time, you know, on the islands, and the people were so friendly and hospitable. And I can remember bringing over a couple of cartons of books and things, which they all enjoyed, the children over there. And in one village, they even had an evening farewell for me, you know, for coming over to see them and help, you know, bringing things like that. And the Polynesians, well, you get to know them, and they're a very strong people. They love their old sport and rugby. They're relaxed. All right, they can be very quick-tempered, especially if you offend them in intimate ways. You have to be very careful about that. And unfortunately, a few have fallen by the wayside, crime-wise. But Otahuhu College. Another thing I like, when I was doing university, good academic history books and philosophy books in the library at Otahuhu College were never borrowed. At university, you couldn't get them because they were always out being borrowed. So I always remember I had one advantage. You could get them. You could get these books quite easily, you know, from the library. And I remember one pupil left Otahuhu College and stole some of those good academic books. And when they finished their degree, they brought them back and asked for a teaching job. So,
yeah. Did they get it?
They didn't from that principal. They did not know. But strangely enough, a year or two later, when that principal had gone, they got it.
So how long have you lived in Papeete?
Since 1965. Yes, 65. I've lived here, the same house, for 30 years. Papeete in those days was known as the Remuera of South Auckland. There were a lot of houses with big sections. There used to be small farms. People also had, chicken farms. There was a lot of that here. Horse. People often had horses and things like that. And there was a famous duck farm here. Yes, there were small farms like that. And of course, as you know, Papeete now has been gradually urbanised, etc. But there's still some of the old houses. See, we've got one of the big... I'm living now with a third of an acre. A lot of them were third of an acre. Well, I've still got one of those third of an acre sections. It's lovely and quiet and peaceful. You wouldn't know what's going on around you. But not many of those are left. There was one teacher at Otahuhu College, Miss Foley. She's 88, and she lives right here in Papeete, the main street, and she has a 4-acre property down a right away and a 6-bedroomed house. She lives on her own. It's lovely. It's like going back 60 years ago. She won't move until she has to move, until she has a heart attack or dies. But she lets people come in there and play, children and that type of thing, but I often visit her, and it's so... It brings back a question of nostalgia, you know, a lovely old driveway with native trees where horse and coach used to come in, and this enormous, weatherboard house. And she's got 15 neighbours, but she's done very well money-wise, probably stock market or something, so she keeps it up. But you just go there, and the books look as though they haven't been shifted from the shelves in 60 years in her home. She's on her own at the moment, although, you know, she gets regular visitors type of thing. But that's what I like about Papeete. You get an old house and a lovely bit of land there. If you look after it, it's very attractive. It's very relaxing. My wife has over 200 roses, some of the best quality roses here in our section. People come to see them and photograph them.
Now you've retired, what are your occupations?
Well, I do book reviews for magazines, history magazines. I'm secretary of the Papeete History Society, you know, and write little articles for them. What else do I do?
Didn't you write the History of Sacred Heart?
Yes. Oh, that's right. I wrote the Centenary History of Sacred Heart College. That was interesting because I interviewed so many, well-educated people, if you understand, and got some great stories from them, especially chaps had been to the war. And we sold them all too, fortunately, eventually. But what was I saying about school? Oh, yes, it was very interesting because by doing that school history, I went to Auckland Grammar, Mount Albert and King's and looked up their records, and it was very interesting to see different schools, different schools had good relations. There weren't so many in those days. It was the sort of the old traditional schools, and they had. You look back, the different results of sports results from school to school, and it built up a great system of friendship among schools, I thought, in those days. And, the old school tie. Strange enough, I found out, in 1950, 35% of the doctors in Auckland had been to Auckland Grammar, King's College, or Sacred Heart. You see, that's what it was, they were classic schools in those days, and...
Do you ever get back to Wairakei these days?
Yes, occasionally, yes. I've got an old aunt who's there, 95, and she's still living there, go to see her. Generally, I like going back to school reunions. Generally, it's mainly for funerals, strange enough. I should meet up with some of the old people there, for funerals. And I went back, to open that help with the unveiling of that Maori memorial, little things like that, go back for. But
well, we're coming to the end of the tape, I'm afraid, so I think.